Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
Our source today gives us this really remarkable, detailed snapshot of a world that is just in profound transition. We are going to be systematically diving into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, January 2, 2026.
Right.
Our goal here is to cut through all the noise and really deliver the most essential, actionable insights.
And our mission, as always, is to be your expert guides navigating this, well, this incredibly complex landscape of finance, politics, and world affairs. We're going section by section to give you, the listener, shortcuts to the most valuable nuggets of knowledge from today's headlines.
And if we had to sort of characterize the themes of this edition, it really is all about massive handovers of power.
Yeah.
And that's coupled with this relentless accelerating change. We're watching the end of the Buffett investment era, the birth of a frankly, radically new political order in New York City, yeah. And this terrifying acceleration of geopolitical competition that's now pushing military tech thousands of feet under the Arctic ice.
Exactly. It's a moment defined by who's leaving and who's arriving and just how fast these new players are moving. You can see established institutions, luxury retail, urban condos, they're struggling.
Mm.
Meanwhile, these disruptive forces like AI-powered video and super aggressive retail investors are just accelerating. So let's not waste a second. We're unpacking this immediately, starting with the lead stories and, well, the most significant corporate transition of the decade at Berkshire Hathaway.
The first story is, well, it's without a doubt the end of an investment epoch, an era that spans six decades. Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, formally ceded his CEO post at Berkshire Hathaway to his successor, Greg Abel, on New Year's Day, 2026.
And this isn't just a corporate handover.
No.
It feels like the closing chapter on one of the most remarkable and patient careers in financial history.
And what's truly fascinating is how he structured his final year, 2025. It serves as his perfect final lesson in his whole philosophy.
Discipline, long-term thinking.
Patience and capital preservation above all else. I mean, he spent most of the year just waiting while the rest of the market was out there chasing these really frothy valuations.
And that patience, you can see it directly in the numbers. He built up a record-breaking pile of cash.
Unbelievable pile of cash. The article details that he just avoided all the pricey deals the market was rallying on, and that led Berkshire's cash war chest swell to $358
billion. $358 billion? I mean, just to put that in perspective for you, that's more dry powder than the GDP of entire countries.
Medium-sized nations, yeah. It's a staggering amount of capital that's built purely on restraint and this conviction that, you know, better bargains are always just around the corner.
And that restraint wasn't just for big acquisitions. It went deep into his equities portfolio. For the first 9 months of 2025, Berkshire was a net seller of stocks.
For the third year in a row.
Right. They unloaded a net total of $10 billion more in equities than they purchased.
He even made the calculated, and you have to think almost painful, move of trimming his exposure to one of the crown jewels of his portfolio, Apple.
Which is huge. He'd previously called Apple one of Berkshire's four giants.
Exactly. Alongside the insurance empire, BNSF Railway, and the energy business. And yet, despite Apple stock climbing another, 9.5% through Tuesday, he sold over 60 million shares in the second and third quarters.
That is such a classic Buffett move. He's recognizing that even a great company might be getting near peak valuation, and he prioritizes cash over what he sees as, you know, maybe short-term gains.
So if he was selling, what was he buying?
Well, his one big purchase in 2025 was really telling. It was a $10 billion cash deal for Occidental Petroleum's chemical producer, OxyChem.
A classic industrial value-based asset?
Totally. Occidental needed the cash to pay down its debt, and Buffett was there to provide the liquidity. And you have to assume, as one analyst said, that he got the asset at a discount. It's a purchase rooted in tangible industrial strength, not some, you know, ephemeral tech valuation.
Chris Bloomstrand, who is the president of Semper Augustus Investments Group and a longtime Berkshire investor, he summarized this exit strategy just perfectly. He said Buffett leaves, having invested the same way he did for six decades, quote, patiently opportunistic and never placing the company in harm's way.
And that phrase, never placing the company in harm's way, that is so key. But it also highlights the uncertainty of what happens now. Berkshire's stock is already down more than 6% since the succession was announced.
The market's reacting to the loss of the Oracle's touch, even with a steady hand like Abel in place.
And we're also seeing these personnel shifts that signal change. Todd Combs, one of Buffett's key investment lieutenants and the CEO of Geico, he's leaving for JPMorgan Chase.
On top of that, the longtime finance chief Mark Hamburg is retiring in June. These aren't just, you know, normal turnover. It feels like the inevitable institutional settling that happens when a charismatic central figure leaves.
And this is where we really have to dig into the core implication that Bill Stone at Glenview Trust brought up. He said, when you don't have Buffett as the magnet, it gets to be more like a normal company. So what does normal actually mean for Berkshire?
Well, normal means they lose that unique halo that Buffett provided. That halo protected them from things like antitrust scrutiny. It let them make deals without the same kind of political blowback other big conglomerates face.
Right. A normal company has to worry about regulators. So, for example, when Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern were in those massive rail merger talks and everyone thought Berkshire's BNSF would get involved,
Buffett just sidestepped it. He opted for a smaller partnership with CSX instead.
And that sidestepping might reflect the new, more conservative approach under Able. Without Buffett's singular presence, the internal appetite, and maybe more importantly, the external tolerance for these huge market reshaping bets is probably a lot lower.
Buffett could manage the political risk of those bets through sheer personal goodwill.
Able can't.
No, it's a profound shift from the oracle of market vision to a focus on maximizing operational excellence within the businesses they already have. So for you, the listener, the key takeaway here is that Berkshire's growth engine is now going to rely far more on execution and a lot less on that unparalleled deal-making genius.
So moving from the temperate quiet of Omaha to a much, much chillier and frankly far more aggressive frontier, the Arctic.
China's accelerating push into the high north isn't just commercial. It is opening up an alarming shortcut that has some chilling military implications for the U.S. and its NATO allies.
This is a huge geopolitical story. It shows how fast climate change is reshaping global security. Chinese research submarines, for the very first time, successfully navigated thousands of feet under the Arctic ice just this past summer.
And U.S. national security officials are seeing this as, you know, undeniable evidence of a growing multi-layered threat in the region.
And China has rather audaciously declared itself a near-Arctic power.
A near-Arctic power, right. An informal designation that Beijing hopes will get it a seat at the table with Russia and the U.S. So what are the specific layers of their objective here? Because it's obviously not just scientific research.
Oh, absolutely not. The objectives are triangulated. First, it's commercial. They see the Arctic as a shortcut for global commerce, their so-called Polar Silk Road.
And that shortcut is becoming more viable every year because of melting ice.
Exactly. A Chinese container ship recently sailed to Poland by skirting the North Pole, and it cut the transit time in half compared to the Suez Canal route. When you cut global supply chain time in half, the economic incentive is just irresistible.
Okay, so that's commercial. The second and far more concerning layer is the military objective.
Right. Positioning nuclear-armed submarines closer to potential U.S. targets is the obvious goal. The top NATO military leader, General Alexis Grinkiewicz, he pointed out that Chinese research missions are often just thinly veiled covers for military purposes. He said China is being more and more aggressive.
And the third objective, which might be the most critical one, is data collection. Specifically, anti-submarine warfare, or ASW, data.
Yeah, and naval strategist Hunter Sturz had this really sobering quote that just crystallizes it. He said China isn't fielding the world's largest fleet of oceanographic survey ships simply to save the whales.
That's the core insight we need to drill down on here. Submarine warfare relies completely on detailed knowledge of the environment, the ocean floor, the water temperature, the currents.
And China's submarines are, right now, considered relatively noisy. They're easier for U.S. forces to track in the open ocean, so they need these detailed maps and computer models to have any hope of evading detection.
The Arctic environment, with its changing ice and its unique acoustics, just fundamentally complicates traditional submarine detection.
So the information they're gathering on these deep Arctic voyages lets their scientists build proprietary computer models of the undersea conditions. This data is the strategic key. It allows their Navy to plot routes for freer operation and turn a weakness, their noisy subs, into a strategic strength, undetectable passage.
And the military balance of power really highlights the urgency. Russia dominates the region with over 40 operational icebreakers. China is moving at an incredible speed.
They commissioned their fifth icebreaker last year, and they built their first domestically designed vessel in just 10 months. That kind of rapid, efficient execution is really worrying the Arctic countries.
In stark contrast, the U.S. only has two operational vessels, though the paper notes President Trump is moving to buy more and has pressured Denmark to expand defenses around Greenland.
NATO's responding by beefing up submarine hunting patrols out of Iceland, but the Sino-Russian cooperation is what really seals the threat.
Since 2023, they've been coordinating maritime law enforcement, developing northern sea routes. General Gregory Guillot of NORAD told Congress that recent joint patrols by Chinese and Russian military planes near Alaska raised the explicit prospect of a joint attack by America's most powerful adversaries.
So this is no longer a localized issue. A French admiral, Pierre Vendier, he views the possibility of China's navy sailing from the Pacific to the Atlantic over the Arctic as a huge game changer.
Because it bypasses traditional routes like the Panama Canal that are easily watched.
Exactly. It means the Pacific threat is no longer contained to the Pacific. It becomes, in his words, ubiquitous. And that reshapes NATO and U.S. defense strategy globally. For you, the listener, you have to understand. The Arctic is rapidly becoming the next critical front in great power competition.
Now let's pivot sharply from that kind of high-stakes military strategy to domestic economics, and specifically, the struggling urban core. Condo owners are facing the worst market conditions in over a decade.
Right, and this softness really reflects a potentially permanent shift in how people view urban life.
While single-family home prices are still edging higher because of a sustained supply shortage, U.S. condominium prices posted their biggest annual decline since 2012, earlier last year.
And the data is definitive. Prices fell 1.9% year over year in September and October of 2025, according to Intercontinental Exchange.
The Zillow numbers are even more granular. They show that more than 1 in 10 condos had a lower estimated value in November than their most recent sale price.
And in some markets, what they're calling crisis markets, like Austin, San Antonio, San Francisco.
Portland,
yeah. The situation is dire. Over a quarter of the condos there are estimated to be underwater.
So we need to analyze the factors driving this, which seem to be about these fundamental changes in what buyers want.
The first is just the enduring reality of work from home. If you don't have to be in the office 5 days a week, the high cost and, you know, the hassle of downtown living becomes a lot less attractive.
People are prioritizing space, quiet, a yard, all the things single-family homes offer, often for less than a cramped downtown condo.
The second major factor is the spiraling cost of ownership, which is giving buyers some serious pause. Homeowner association fees, HOA dues, they can easily run over $1,000 a month.
And they're rising fast because of two big pressures. Skyrocketing insurance premiums, especially in places like Florida, and then all the deferred maintenance costs from the pandemic.
And we can't ignore what the paper calls the ghost of Surfside. That 2021 Florida condo collapse just fundamentally changed the lending landscape. Lenders are now scrutinizing condo buildings much more closely. They're requiring proof of sufficient insurance and repair reserves.
Which makes it hard for buyers to even get mortgages for units in older buildings that need major repairs, especially in Florida, where they have new structural soundness requirements.
All of this creates a huge dilemma for sellers. People like Janice and Edward Grimm in South Carolina, they had to cut their price below what they paid in 2022 because of the slow market and high fees. They feel like they're going to lose big time.
So it leads to what the article calls a standoff. Almost 7% of condo sellers just took their homes off the market in September.
That's the highest rate for that month since 2015.
Right. These sellers, many of whom have low or no mortgages, are just choosing to wait it out, betting that buyers will eventually come back. Meanwhile, equally patient buyers are holding out for big price cuts. The market is just stuck in neutral.
It really reflects a deep, sustained shift away from dense urban living and towards suburban space.
And speaking of the pressures defining urban life and the urgent need for housing solutions, this financial struggle for condo owners is exactly the kind of crisis the newest and youngest mayor of New York City, Zoran Mamdani, is pledging to solve.
Mamdani, the 34-year-old Democratic Socialist, took office with an immediate, unmistakable signal that the Adams era is over.
He's the city's first Muslim leader and the youngest mayor in over 100 years. The oath, administered by Senator Bernie Sanders, just sort of signaled his alignment with the progressive left.
And he wasted absolutely no time. The paper called it an audacious start. His very first executive order revoked all orders made by former mayor Eric Adams dating back to September 26, 2024.
The day Adams was charged with federal corruption.
Exactly. That symbolic sweep was, well, it was politically brilliant. He rescinded Adams's orders that prevented the city from shedding investments in Israel and, somewhat intimately, the order that established an Office of Rodent Mitigation.
And then he immediately signed orders to develop task forces to champion tenants' rights.
His ambitious agenda is all centered on tackling the cost of living head on. He promised a sweeping 4-year rent freeze on all rent-regulated apartments, expanding free childcare, and, maybe most expensively, creating a free bus system,
which is estimated to cost $800 million a year.
Now, here is the tightrope walk. That rent freeze promise, it helped catapult him to victory. It tapped into this deep popular frustration. But economists, I mean, almost universally, they argue that price controls deter investment and lead to long-run undersupply and housing decay.
I have to challenge that promise. Economically, isn't promising a 4-year rent freeze just ignoring basic market mechanics for, you know, ideological purity?
Well,
if you cap rental revenue, landlords don't have the incentive to maintain buildings or invest in new construction.
Yeah.
It leads to decay and shortages, and that ultimately hurts the very tenants you're trying to help. So how does he navigate that fundamental criticism?
He's betting on political will overriding those market mechanisms. But he faces monumental resistance from the city's powerful elite Wall Street real estate developers, who are already very wary of his plans to raise taxes on the wealthy to cover the price tag.
And the rent freeze only affects about a quarter of the city's housing stock.
Yeah.
To get quick, visible results, he needs cooperation.
That's why his immediate outreach attempts are so telling. He acknowledged his detractors, saying, "If you are a New Yorker, I am your mayor." And crucially, he's hosting roundtables on affordable housing red tape, and he persuaded Police Commissioner Jessica Tisch to stay on.
Keeping Tisch is a huge gesture toward appeasing critics who are worried about his policing proposals, like replacing some officers with a new agency deploying mental health teams. He needs stability in the NYPD.
But the warning he received is stark. A former advisor to Bill de Blasio stated bluntly, "New Yorkers have no patience, and he has about a week to deliver."
That puts immense pressure on him to expand programs that have immediate visible results, like free childcare, that has broad popular appeal and is quicker to deliver, while he simultaneously fights the long-term, politically charged battle over the rent freeze and the free bus system.
He's trying to balance ideology with this urgent, practical need for a quick win.
Turning to the federal executive branch, attention is focused on President Trump, now 79 years old, and the increasingly visible signs of aging that are emerging both in public and in private.
The reports from aides, donors, and friends, they all paint a pretty consistent picture. They note they often have to speak loudly in meetings because the president strains to hear.
He's also been observed struggling to keep his eyes open during several televised events in the West Wing. His diet, heavy on fatty and salty foods, remains a concern, and his vigorous schedule provides very little sleep.
What's particularly striking is his medical defiance. He insists on taking 325 milligrams of aspirin daily for cardiac prevention, and he's ignoring his doctor's preference for the much lower 81 milligram dose.
He's held this preference for 25 years due to superstition, stating he wants, quote, "nice, thin blood pouring through my heart."
But that large dose has a visible cost. It causes him to bruise easily. This was publicly evident at the Republican National Convention when his attorney general, Pam Bondi, inadvertently nicked him with her ring during a high five.
And it caused his hand to bleed dramatically. He even admitted to staff that he covers bruising on his hands with makeup after he gets, quote, "whacked again by someone."
He also briefly tried, but then stopped, wearing compression socks for a diagnosed condition called superficial chronic venous insufficiency,
which is a mild swelling in the lower legs.
Right. It's caused by faulty valves in the veins. The socks help with circulation, but he didn't like them and abandoned them quickly.
And he expressed this palpable regret over allowing any medical scrutiny at all. He was advised to get advanced imaging in October 2025, a CT scan, which he first misidentified as an MRI to rule out any cardiovascular issues.
The results showed no abnormalities, but he regretted taking it. He said, "In retrospect, it's too bad I took it because it gave him a little ammunition for media coverage."
And that regret really highlights the political sensitivity around presidential health. However, the White House staff continues to push a very different narrative.
Yeah. Navy Captain Sean Barbabella, Trump's doctor, maintains he is in exceptional health and perfectly suited to execute his duties. They're citing an AI-assisted analysis from the Mayo Clinic that estimated his cardiac age as 65.
Significantly younger than his chronological age.
Right. And the president himself denies the signs of fatigue, claiming he only closes his eyes because it is very relaxing. He credits his energy and health to very good genetics.
Despite those denials, aides have quietly encouraged him to shorten his presentations and consciously try to keep his eyes open during public events, which just shows the inherent political image problem that comes with visible aging in the Oval Office.
Now we look at President Trump's political priorities playing out in domestic policy, starting with a, Well, an unexpected yet very telling tariff rollback.
Indeed. President Trump delayed tariff increases, which were set to jump to 30 or 50% on upholstered furniture, kitchen cabinets, and vanities for a whole year, keeping them at 25%.
And this walkback followed earlier rollbacks on agricultural goods.
The motivation is clearly consumer frustration over high prices. Consumer prices for household furnishings had risen 4.6% in November from the year prior.
And the White House justified the delay by citing productive negotiations with trade partners.
It's a striking contradiction, though. It really encapsulates the tension in his trade policy. The president's allies claim his protectionist tariffs are a success, even as he's carving out hundreds of exceptions.
He's essentially trying to cover the inflationary damage from his own policies without ever admitting that the policy itself failed.
But the second policy item is a pure flashpoint of alleged political retribution. The president's surprise veto of the Arkansas Valley Conduit Water Project bill in Colorado.
This project was completely non-controversial. It had passed Congress unanimously.
The measure was designed to bring fresh water to eastern Colorado communities, many of which are Trump voters. And the White House offered this generic claim that the veto was about preventing taxpayers from funding expensive and unreliable policies.
But the political response was immediate and scathing. Colorado's Democratic senators, Michael Bennett and John Hickenlooper, they immediately labeled the veto payback and mob boss tactics.
And they linked the action directly to Trump's previous attempts to pressure Colorado Governor Jared Polis to release Tina Peters,
the former election clerk who was convicted of a voting machine security breach. This is a remarkable public assertion of political blackmail.
And what makes this so damaging is that even staunch Trump supporters, like Representative Lauren Boebert, who spearheaded the bill, publicly questioned the president's priorities.
She wrote in a statement that she hoped the veto has nothing to do with political retribution.
I have to ask, for an issue this non-controversial, isn't vetoing a unanimous bipartisan infrastructure bill a huge self-inflicted political wound, regardless of the motive?
Oh, absolutely.
It harms his own voters, and it alienates allies like Boebert. It seems to underscore a willingness to sacrifice widely supported policy purely for political leverage.
Absolutely. The president demonstrated a willingness to use executive power to enforce political will against state governors who cross him, no matter the domestic political fallout. It signals that legislative success, even unanimous success, means nothing if the local politics aren't aligned with the White House's immediate demands.
Moving internationally now, Russia is dramatically escalating its aerial attacks on Ukraine's economic lifeline, the Black Sea port of Odessa.
Right. This port is the chief hub for Ukraine's crucial grain exports.
Odessa is now under what you can only call a sustained economic siege. Relentless Russian strikes, primarily using cheap Iranian-made drones fired from Crimea, are targeting infrastructure, storage facilities, and power grids.
And around 90% of Ukraine's agricultural produce is exported by sea. Odessa handled about 76 million tons of cargo over 11 months of 2025. It is the core of Ukraine's remaining functional economy.
The data on Russia's escalation is just stark. In 2025 alone, Russia launched approximately 52,000 drones in overnight attacks.
52,000. Compare that to only about 14,000 launched in the entire two-year period from 2022 to 2024 combined.
It's a massive industrialized effort to degrade Ukraine's ability to earn any revenue.
And military analysts confirm the surge reflects Russia's clear goal of economic degradation. One expert explicitly stated Russia is, quote, trying to destroy all key elements of the export logistics chains. The war is shifting further into economic annihilation.
And against this backdrop, Ukrainian President Zelensky is planning for a massive post-war military. He's seeking to maintain 800,000 active personnel.
A figure European leaders recently agreed to back with a substantial 90 billion euro or $105 billion loan.
But the problem isn't the loan. It's the fiscal reality of sustaining a military that large long-term. Ukraine currently spends around 30% of its GDP on defense, even with all the allied support.
That $105 billion EU loan is a short-term boost, but maintaining 800,000 troops is astronomically expensive. For comparison, that loan is roughly what Germany is expected to spend on its military next year, and Germany has only about a quarter of Ukraine's planned personnel.
Defense analysts are unanimous. Ukraine has to pivot to a more sustainable, cost-effective model for its future force.
Right. Experts recommend aiming for a smaller, highly efficient active force of maybe 300,000 to 500,000, relying much more heavily on reserve forces for rapid mobilization.
The financial priority should be on cost-effective, high-impact capabilities. Air defense to counter the drone surge, and long-range missiles for deep strikes.
Yeah, Michael Kaufman of the Carnegie Endowment strongly advised against costly items like jet fighters, which could just eat up Ukraine's entire defense budget. The viable post-war military has to be built around capabilities that are more cost-effective, like drones, like mines.
Let's pivot to the Middle East, where we're highlighting two nations moving along radically different and contradictory trajectories. Iran is convulsing due to economic hardship, while Saudi Arabia is quietly liberalizing.
In Iran, violence erupted on the fifth day of protests over the country's severe economic crisis, leaving at least 5 people dead. The core drivers are intense, immediate deprivation.
Fueled by 42% inflation and a currency, the rial, that has lost 60% of its value since the June war with Israel.
These protests began with merchants in Tehran's Grand Bazaar, which is always a bellwether for economic pain. But these economic grievances are rapidly turning political. You can see it in the proliferation of chants like death to the dictator.
The regime's initial response was a cautious attempt at damage control. They sacked the central bank chief as a scapegoat.
But that quickly turned to severe repression. Hardliners have promised a firm response, with the prosecutor general warning that any attempt to turn protests into destruction of public property would face a legal, proportionate, and firm response.
The level of repression is deeply alarming. Human rights groups documented that executions nearly doubled in 2025, rising to over 1,870 people, often carried out in secret to intimidate the population.
An Iran expert noted, the only strategy the regime knows is repression.
And in stark, almost jarring contrast, Saudi Arabia is quietly breaking a long-standing religious taboo by permitting some wealthy non-Muslim residents to purchase alcohol.
This is a highly calculated move by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. It's part of his Vision 2030 plan to diversify the economy, attract high-earning expats, and expand tourism.
All critical as they prepare to host the 2034 World Cup and Formula One events.
The initial location is an unmarked store in Riyadh's diplomatic quarter, which really underscores the discreet nature of this reform. And this follows other significant steps, like lifting the ban on women driving and allowing cinemas.
Analysts confirm that Dubai is the clear benchmark for these reforms. Future liberalization is expected at exclusive hotels and resorts along the Red Sea coast.
The strategy is to retain elites and attract tourists while navigating religious sensitivities by keeping the ban in holy cities like Mecca and Medina. The message is clear. The kingdom is willing to trade some religious orthodoxy for economic viability.
Turning now to business and finance, we start with the story of struggle in luxury retail, which contrasts sharply with the rise of the new financial power players.
Saks Global is preparing to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after missing a critical interest payment of over $100 million on its debt.
And this expected filing involves a massive consolidation that was supposed to create a luxury retail behemoth,
including Saks, Neiman Marcus, Bergdorf Goodman, and Saks OFF 5TH.
But the merger, far from creating a juggernaut, faltered completely. The debt load was just unsustainable, and that was coupled with a continuing slump in global luxury goods sales.
And that financial distress translated directly into operational paralysis. Saks struggled severely to pay its vendors, so some major suppliers just withheld shipments.
Which led to weaker merchandise on the sales floor. And that creates a vicious cycle. Weak merchandise means fewer sales, which widens the losses, making it even harder to pay vendors.
The financials confirm the crisis. Sales for the quarter ended August 2nd fell by more than 13% from a year earlier, dropping to $1.6 billion. Its net loss subsequently widened to $288 million.
Despite attempts to raise fresh capital and sell off assets, the debt load was just too much to reorganize without Chapter 11 protection.
Now for the complete opposite story. The market's new power center. 2025 was the year individual investors transformed into a financial force, acting as price setters in multiple markets.
Scott Rubner of Citadel Securities noted that retail investors are no longer just passive followers. They are now a dominant force in the market.
And this is a new, more aggressive, and more sophisticated cohort compared to past amateur traders. They're using technology and social media for coordination and information gathering in ways that really challenge institutional dominance.
The metrics are just staggering. According to JP Morgan Chase data, individual investors poured a record amount of money into stocks and ETFs in 2025, topping the frenetic levels of the 2021 meme stock craze.
And this wasn't a flash in the pan. It was sustained, deliberate buying.
Their influence isn't just limited to equities either. their share of options trading volumes is near record highs, which indicates a higher tolerance for risk and sophistication.
Plus, they funneled the most dollars into the leading gold ETF in 5 years, signaling that they're diversifying into hard assets, a strategy that's usually reserved for institutional or so-called smart money.
This massive sustained buying spree was a primary engine powering the broader market, helping the S&P 500 move toward a 16% gain in 2025. That marks the index's third back-to-back year of double-digit gains.
It represents a fundamental challenge to the long-standing dominance of professional banks and institutions. This cohort is demanding access to high-risk, high-reward assets, and they are moving the needle.
Shifting to massive tech disruption, let's look at Meta. Just a few years ago, Meta's Reels, the short-form video on Instagram and Facebook, was seen as this struggling, late-to-market TikTok copycat.
And now, it has reached an astounding $50 billion annual run rate.
$50 billion. That's projected annual revenue on a scale comparable to established global giants like Coca-Cola and Nike. It is a stunning turnaround.
And CEO Mark Zuckerberg credits the company's underlying technological transformation, their AI recommendation systems.
The paper notes that Zuckerberg claims this AI has been delivering higher quality, more relevant content, and that drove a remarkable 30% increase in time spent watching videos on Instagram.
To appreciate this pivot, you have to remember that as recently as 2022, internal Meta research showed Instagram users were spending only one-tenth the time watching Reels as they did on TikTok.
They had to completely re-engineer their algorithm. They moved away from relying on the traditional following graph, showing you content from accounts you already followed, to finding what users liked from accounts they didn't even follow.
This AI-driven discovery engine was the key that unlocked that massive engagement.
And the data validates the success. The average Instagram user now spends 27 minutes a day watching Reels. This surpasses YouTube Shorts, which is at 21 minutes.
Still trails TikTok's main feed, though, which commands 44 minutes.
But Meta is not resting on its laurels. Their future expansion plans are designed to capture the lucrative living room market. They plan to expand Reels to TV, starting with a test on Amazon Fire TV devices.
They're also rolling out new features like Blend, which creates custom social video feeds based on a user's and their friends' algorithms. The goal is to make living room viewing a highly social, personalized experience.
Our next story connects the AI boom directly to geopolitical tensions and the war for talent. Meta is further cementing its AI dominance by acquiring the advanced AI tool Manus for $2.5 billion.
Which includes a substantial $500 million employee retention pool.
Manus became successful because its advanced AI agent could handle highly complex tasks, like producing a 100-page research report or building a website autonomously.
And the company was founded by young Chinese entrepreneurs. This is where the geopolitical tension comes in.
The founders made these strategic, deliberate decisions to distance the company from its Chinese roots to make sure the deal could happen smoothly. Specifically, Manus moved its headquarters to Singapore and laid off its remaining Chinese staff.
This move was a necessary attempt to navigate Western scrutiny and bypass U.S. restrictions on outbound investments in key technologies. It paved the way for this massive American acquisition. The founders basically realized that to achieve global scale and get major Western capital, they couldn't stay physically rooted in China.
Winston Ma of NYU Law noted that if the deal closes smoothly, it creates a new path for young AI startups in China. It signals that if you want billions in Western funding and a global market, you have to relocate your operations.
And crucially, the reaction in Washington was notably muted. Officials who were previously worried about a mere $75 million funding round for Manus now seem resigned. Experts see this as evidence that U.S. export and investment restrictions are effectively pressuring Chinese AI firms to strike deals with U.S. partners.
We wrap up the business section with two parallel trends related to content and productivity. First, the newsletter boom. 2025 was definitively the year of the newsletter, and it's fundamentally reshaping the media landscape.
This shift is publisher-driven. They're capitalizing on the audience's desire for trusted, direct-to-consumer voices. Publishers have lost reliable traffic from two key sources, Facebook and Google's increasing reliance on AI summaries,
which often starve external links of clicks.
Exactly. Newsletters offer an unmediated direct connection to the reader's inbox.
The growth metrics are just explosive. Substack counted 5 million paid subscriptions in early 2025, up about 67% over the prior year. They even raised $100 million at a $1.1 billion valuation.
And a new competitor, Beehive, doubled its revenue to $28 million. We are seeing major figures, Tina Brown in media, Michael Burry in finance, Charlie XCX in pop culture launching hugely popular newsletters.
The second trend is a bizarre yet telling perk emerging in hyper-competitive tech offices, nicotine pouches. Products like Zyn, Sesh, and Lucy are becoming common perks.
They're even being offered in free fridges and vending machines at companies like Palantir Technologies and Hello Patient.
Wait, so Palantir is stocking fridges with free Zyn. We've officially moved past ping pong tables and free kombucha to institutionalizing mild nicotine addiction in the name of biohacking and hyperproductivity.
It's wild.
That is a wild reflection of the pressure in the tech sector.
It is, but it's rooted in a specific culture. Users, often from the biohacking world, claim the stimulant boosts productivity and focus, and crucially, it avoids the long half-life and eventual crash you get with high-dose caffeine.
One founder admitted to accidentally getting addicted after initially buying them as a joke for the office.
And medical experts are, you know, understandably quite concerned. While nicotine pouches are a less harmful delivery system than smoking, they worry this trend is introducing nicotine addiction to a whole new population of non-users, young, highly educated tech workers who previously wouldn't have touched the stuff.
And they cite the risk of elevated blood pressure, which puts users at risk for heart attacks and strokes. It's a perfect microcosm of the modern tech world, optimizing performance at the expense of long-term health.
We turn now to the opinion pages, starting with Chief Justice John Roberts' year-end report on the federal judiciary, a document that usually serves as a subtle political statement.
Roberts used his report to deliver a powerful assertion of the judiciary's constitutional role. He stressed that the judiciary remains a counter-majoritarian check on the political branches.
He extolled the 236-year-old arrangement designed to safeguard the independence of federal judges.
This message is being interpreted as an indirect yet clear address to the severe criticism the Supreme Court faced throughout 2025.
Right. Critics, including the court's three liberal justices, accused the conservative majority of being far too deferential to President Trump. They allowed over 20 controversial, high-impact policies to take effect, even after lower courts had ruled them illegal.
He notably defended judges against political threats, specifically impeachment threats based on their rulings. He recounted the historical 1804 impeachment attempt of Justice Samuel Chase to make the critical point that mere disapproval of a judge's decisions is an invalid and dangerous basis for removal.
And finally, the report contains some concrete data reflecting the impact of the administration's intense focus on immigration. It noted that criminal cases against defendants accused of immigration-related crimes surged 27% in fiscal year 2025.
Continuing a 30% surge from the prior year, this just reflects the administrative priority shifting resources toward enforcement and prosecution, driving up the federal caseload dramatically.
We have two incredibly sharp economic arguments following that, focusing on infrastructure failure and global economic warfare. First, Clifford Winston argues that privatizing U.S. airports could spur much-needed innovation.
His argument is structural. Winston says public U.S. airports fail to innovate, for example, by failing to install heated runways to reduce expensive snow delays because they lack the fundamental economic incentive.
He cited a cost-benefit analysis of Boston-area airports, including Logan, showing they wouldn't install them because the profit motive was missing to justify the initial costs.
He draws a smart analogy to ride-sharing Uber and Lyft, noting that the profit motive is what drives beneficial services for travelers. Privatization, he says, would allow airports to charge airlines a premium for more reliable, snow-delay-free service, creating the incentive to innovate.
The second, far more massive economic argument comes from Ram Charan. He views China's expected $1 trillion 2025 trade surplus not just as successful trade, but as nothing less than economic conquest.
And the surplus is enabled by China's staggering 90% excess production capacity.
That 90% excess capacity is the key statistic. It allows Beijing to flood global markets with subsidized exports at artificially low prices, effectively wiping out competing industries in the U.S. and allied nations.
Charan urges President Trump to treat this like a coordinated war, arguing that the U.S. can't fight alone. We need to coordinate with allies who represent $60 trillion in combined GDP.
He proposes five steps, one of which is creating a dedicated Department of Manufacturing to rebuild self-sufficiency in 10 critical sectors, like AI, biopharma, and aerospace. This is a call for strategic industrial policy, not just reactive tariffs.
But the central leverage point is his call for deploying a coordinated counterforce using export controls on specialized inputs that China absolutely cannot produce internally.
Right. We're talking about small dollar items like ultra-pure chemicals for semiconductors or specialty catalysts for advanced manufacturing. If coordinated among allies, cutting off these specialized inputs would inflict a threshold of pain on Beijing's industrial machine, forcing them to the negotiating table.
On social fault lines, Tunku Varadarajan details the severe and rapidly escalating rise in Hindu attacks on India's Christians since Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power in 2014.
The statistics are deeply concerning. Anti-Christian attacks rose from a reported 139 incidents in 2014 to 834 in 2024.
And the article gives these chilling examples from Christmas 2025, where mobs trashed displays, assaulted a young blind woman, and chanted, "Death to Christian missionaries outside churches."
Varadarajan's core criticism is aimed at PM Modi's silence on this violence. Despite Modi attending mass and speaking vaguely of peace, hardline activists continue their violent actions with apparent impunity, suggesting implicit political protection.
This surge in unchecked violence led the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom to recommend designating India a country of particular concern.
Domestically, California is grappling with a major political dilemma surrounding a union-backed ballot initiative for a one-time 5% wealth tax.
This would be levied on residents with over $1 billion in net worth, targeting roughly 200 billionaires in the state.
The tax is structurally complex, as it would apply not just to liquid assets, but also to illiquid and intangible assets like private equity stakes and patents at their fair market value as of December 31, 2026. This creates a massive dilemma for Governor Gavin Newsom.
Newsom opposes state-level wealth taxes for fear of driving away the affluent taxpayers who bankroll the state and pay half the state's income tax. But now he has to choose between appeasing the powerful progressive left and preserving the state's financial base. It's a classic political tightrope walk.
And finally, Richard V. Reeves addresses the K-12 system. He argues that the social and economic problems leading to the class divide in marriage, where women seek economically viable mates, start early in education because boys consistently lag behind girls,
particularly by almost a full grade level in literacy.
The data supports him. In the bottom 10% of students in terms of performance, there are twice as many boys as girls. Reeves suggests reforms are needed to redesign the educational environment to better suit boys' developmental needs,
proposing things like more hands-on learning and competitive opportunities. He also stresses the critical need to increase the shrinking share of male educators, which has fallen from 33% to just 23%.
Our final opinion section includes two powerful pieces on the nature of conflict and medical progress. Barton Swaim's piece, "In Ukraine, Give War a Chance," tackles President Trump's recent push for a premature peace deal.
Swaim argues that Trump's shuttle diplomacy and push for a quick peace only pauses the conflict and prolongs the inevitable conclusion. He fights the military scholar Edward Luttwak's theory that peace sometimes requires the exhaustion of the belligerents.
War, Luttwak argues, eventually destroys itself by consuming the will and resources of the participants.
Swaim agitates for continuing to arm Ukraine to accelerate that exhaustion, while simultaneously demanding immediate economic pressure on Iran. He points out that Tehran is currently evading oil sanctions at high levels, exporting 2 million barrels a day, mocking the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
Then we have Ryan Chrisman detailing the biological revolution, how AIDS helps cure cancer. This describes the profound ethical and medical revolution of using viral vectors, specifically AAV and lentiviral vectors, to deliver therapeutic genes for gene therapy.
This is a complex but crucial area. AAV vectors are often used, but they deliver genes that typically remain outside the cell's nucleus and are eventually lost. The lentiviral vectors, though, are derived from HIV.
And they are revolutionary because they can integrate the therapeutic genes directly into a patient's DNA, making the correction permanent.
That capability for integration is essential for treating complex hereditary diseases like sickle cell anemia, where a permanent fix is required.
Chrisman highlights the 2025 development of in vivo therapies, like Umoja Biopharma's treatment for leukemia, which delivers instructions directly into the body rather than requiring cells to be removed and treated externally.
And this shift to in vivo delivery drastically cuts the cost and time of treatment, transforming gene therapy from a boutique medicine, which could cost over $1 million a dose, to a potential mainstream solution accessible to millions.
But this profound innovation carries significant ethical challenges. The same technology that can cure muscular dystrophy or sickle cell could, in theory, be misused for cosmetic or selective traits altering human biology for non-medical reasons. This requires regulators to balance innovation with careful ethical oversight.
We have covered an enormous amount of ground in this deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, January 2, 2026.
The defining themes of this edition really show a world moving at two distinct speeds. We saw the patient, deliberate strategy of Warren Buffett exit the stage, replaced by the rapid AI-fueled revenue acceleration of Meta's Reels hitting a $50 billion run rate.
Right. The era of the long-term slow-growth conglomerate is being challenged by the era of hyper-optimized disruption.
And geopolitical conflict is shifting frontiers, moving from traditional theaters like Ukraine's ports, which are under economic siege, to new arenas like the Arctic, where China is seeking military advantage, and the global economy itself, which Ram Charan views as the target of economic conquest.
Critically, we also observe the increasing sophisticated power of the individual. From retail investors acting as price setters in the stock market to writers finding massive success through specialized newsletters bypassing traditional media.
But I keep circling back to that subtle observation in the opinion section about ubiquitous surveillance killing spontaneous expression. In a world defined by the pocket camera, the advice is no longer dance like nobody's watching.
The new cynical rule is dance like anybody could be watching and that footage will follow you forever. It's the self-censorship of the authentic moment.
And that anxiety, that withdrawal from the unplanned, it stands in sharp contrast to the technological trajectory we talked about today. We have hyper-personalized, hyper-optimized AI recommendation engines driving Meta's content success, and we have viral vectors pushing us toward biological solutions that engineer away disease at the genetic root.
Every part of our environment, from our entertainment feed to our DNA, is being optimized and engineered.
So here's the provocative thought for you to carry forward. What does it mean for society when authenticity becomes self-censored and erased by fear of exposure, while technology aggressively pushes us toward highly engineered, deeply invasive content and biological solutions?
Is the next ultimate step of human progress the complete erasure of the unplanned, the chaotic, and the authentic, replaced by perfect engineered optimization, something to mull over as you begin the new year?